This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Students and teachers looking back on this past school year will remember the lessons that were taught and learned, the memories of friendships made and reinforced, and in some places around the country, that time teachers walked off the job for better pay and working conditions. And it worked.
What really got the attention of the politicians is the public supported those passionate educators.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll have a conversation with the president of the National Education Association about those job actions and the future of the union. We'll also hear about a book that shows students how to build their family tree and spend an academic minute listening to what birds are telling us about climate change. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. On February 22nd, more than 20,000 teachers and support staff went on strike in West Virginia, demanding higher pay and lower health care costs. The strike lasted until March 7th and resulted in a 5% pay raise for teachers. When the strike began, West Virginia ranked 48th in teacher pay. On April 2nd, the state that ranked 49th, Oklahoma, had its own 10-day teacher strike. Arizona, Colorado, North Carolina, Kentucky, and Georgia also saw job actions by teachers and support staff during the school year. Here to talk about these teacher walkouts and the future of teachers' unions in the U.S. is Lily Eskelson-Garcia, the president of the National Education Association. That's the largest professional interest group in the U.S. with just under 3 million members. We talked about what sparked teachers across the country to take action this past school year.
This is the year of the teacher. This is the wave of activism, of passion, of excitement. And it's in our most oppressed states that have been cutting school funding for a decade. And it was finally educators saying, you know, we've tried to work very politely and tried to get you to see what it's like to have 40 kids in a classroom and no books and us buying our own supplies. And enough is enough. And they took to their state capitals and they let their voices be heard. I'm so proud of them.
Now, was this a true grassroots thing or was there union involvement?
You have to have both a strong union and you have to have the activism in the hearts of teachers. You know, you can't just have a couple of people at a meeting say, you know, let's close down schools and have everybody, you know, 30,000 people show up at the Capitol tomorrow. That's not the way it works. We really are our members. The National Education Association is over 3 million teachers, support staff, the bus drivers, the school secretaries, the counselors and librarians, the people that work in those public schools, colleges, and universities are real people. And when you have a meeting and people are crying and people are angry and people are saying, whatever we were doing to be nice in the past and just explaining what was going on in our classrooms and hoping that these politicians would hear us, it didn't work. We want to do something that will get their attention. And because they have a union, because they have a group that can say, we will contain, direct, and use this energy in a way that will get not only the attention of the politicians, what really got the attention of the politicians is the public supported those passionate educators. The public said, will you listen to these people? And that's what I think scared the politicians.
In West Virginia, that is really where the attention, they really got their attention. Was that considered, looking back, a success?
West Virginia was a very, very powerful example of what passionate individuals can do when they have a collective voice. You know, individually, those thousands and thousands of underpaid school teachers and support staff could have stood outside, you know, their houses on the sidewalk and just screamed what they needed people to hear, and no one would have heard them. It was their collective voice through their union that took those passionate hearts. And I saw reporters. I was there with those brave people. By the way, they could have lost their jobs, and they knew that. They knew that in their state, they had no right to be there on the steps of the Capitol saying, we cannot allow you to hurt our students like this anymore. We cannot allow you to hurt our profession, being paid $30,000 and have 45 kids in a classroom. We can't allow that to continue. And as reporters walked through the crowds, just putting a microphone in front of a third grade teacher and saying, why are you here? And teachers would cry and they'd talk about their students. And that was the story that was getting out to the public. The public had no idea what these folks were being paid and what they were being asked to do and the money they were spending out of their own family's budget to buy paper and pencils. And it was the public saying to those politicians, you should be ashamed of yourself. And it made a difference. It made a difference in the lives of their students. And that is what caught the wildfire. That was what the brush fire that spread to Oklahoma, Kentucky, Arizona, and beyond.
Do you see this continuing into the next school year? Are there other pockets where some teachers are going to say enough is enough?
You know, you're going to see whatever teachers and support staff, educators, what they need to do, they're prepared to do. But here's what I've already seen. We have seen legislators, and we're talking Republicans and Democrats. We're talking about governors and state legislators and political leaders, state after state, who see the handwriting on the wall. They don't actually want to be the next West Virginia, and neither do we. It's not fun. What we're asking for is for people to hear us and do something about it, and not pat us on the head, not say, oh, we just love you, keep up the good work, and you know, that's not working for anybody, especially for those students. And so we're already seeing those political leaders reaching out to the teacher leaders and saying, we need to sit down and talk. What is it that we need? And by the way, when we go and talk to those folks, we're bringing parents with us. We're bringing business people with us. We're bringing coalitions of advocates for folks with kids with disabilities or English language learners or our dreamers. And we're bringing everybody in, and we're showing the community support for something as essential as a good, great public school in every neighborhood. And because folks are listening in a different way, because they see the power of a collective voice of professionals, they're actually saying, let's work something out. Now, isn't that a better idea than pushing people to the brink where they feel like they have to put their own jobs on the line to save public education?
Well, it's always been very easy for politicians to say they support teachers, but it's also easy for them to beat up on unions. So do you see that continuing?
It's always been amazing to me when some politician will say, I love teachers, but I hate their union. I'm a sixth grade teacher. I was the Utah Teacher of the Year back in 1889 when I was young. And I got more involved in the Utah Education Association, an affiliate of the NEA, because I had 39 kids in my room, and I wanted the legislature to do something about class size, because I was sharing social studies textbooks with my three colleagues. I got the social studies textbooks for a couple of hours on Tuesday afternoon. I mean, it was ridiculous. And it was my union that said, we're going up there and we're going to make some noise about how underfunded our public schools in Utah are. And because we did something very, very similar to what happened in West Virginia, we did that 20 years ago in Utah, we saw incredible increases. You can't do that every year, and you shouldn't have to do that every year. You shouldn't have to be that desperate. But what I knew was it was my union that was my voice as a classroom teacher with too many students to serve. And so for us, we smile when people say we love teachers, but we don't like the union, because we are the union. I am the NEA as a sixth grade teacher. Those folks marching in Arizona, they are the Arizona Education Association. And we know that the only time people listen to us is when our union organizes our collective voice. That's when we're heard.
Well, we're waiting on a Supreme Court decision that might affect the way your union is funded. What are the plans once that comes one way or the other?
Yeah, it's for your listeners, the Janus decision is what we're waiting for. In some states, in about 20 states, the state legislature requires public sector unions, like education unions, to provide services like collective bargaining for non-members. And so they say nobody can be forced to join a union, but since we're requiring this union to bargain for everybody's salary and benefits and defend the contract if there's any breach in that contract, that those unions can charge non-members a fee for those specific services. And it's up to a state legislature to allow that or not. In those states that have what we call fair share fees, they're pretty much our strongest unions. And so the Koch brothers and others that do not like unions figure that they can take away from state legislatures that right to allow agency fees. It's their hope that they can then target our members, because we have very few fee payers. Most of the folks in those states are union members, and to tell them, look, now you can get that, and you won't have to pay for it. They have to give it to you for free. There'll be some people that will fall for that. The whole thing is, if enough people fall for it, then you wouldn't have a union, and you wouldn't have anyone representing you in, say, contract negotiations. And that's, of course, their ultimate goal. So we're preparing ourselves for that attack we know is coming, where they will try and convince our members that, you know, drop your membership in your union because you can get collective bargaining for free now. We think our members will see through that lie. And it is our plan to prepare ourselves and to survive whatever attack they throw at us, and we will come back even stronger. Every one of these job actions that you've seen, from West Virginia to Arizona to North Carolina, have been in states that don't have that agency fee. And we have seen increased membership with that activism. A lot of those younger educators, those folks who are, you know, just got their first teaching job, going, I can see the value in a collective voice that I have in my union. And so we have no intention of silencing ourselves. We're going to keep fighting. We're going to keep being the voice of educators who love their students and care about public education.
Lily Eskelson-Garcia is the president of the National Education Association. When we recorded this interview in early June, the Supreme Court decision on the Janus case had not yet been released. There's a pretty good chance that by the time you hear this, that outcome will have been announced. Still to come, National Geographic wants students to plant some names in their family tree. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Are there some interesting creatures climbing along the branches of your family tree? That's the question students can answer with the new book, National Geographic Kids Guide to Genealogy. The senior editor of National Geographic Children's Books is Priyanka Lamachani, who says this is a topic that more and more students and adults are becoming interested in pursuing.
Well, we found that genealogy obviously has become very popular these days, and I think that may be due to the fact that we have so much access to information now, with a lot of records being digitized and all of these organizations who are encouraging people to get their DNA tested. And we thought it would be a really great idea to get kids involved in learning more about who they are and where they came from. And we wanted to put together a really comprehensive but also really fun guide for kids so that they could start digging into their background. So we have this jam-packed book that has a really fun tone, and which is very accessible and full of activities and fun facts to help kids get started.
What age group are you aiming at?
This is aimed for 8 to 12, but I've heard from lots of adults that they think this book is great for them too, and I would agree with that. But it is geared towards 8 to 12-year-olds. But again, the information is really for all ages.
It's interesting the way you put it together, talking about filling out your family tree as kind of a detective story, right?
Right. We thought that would be a really fun approach to kind of tackle it as detective work. So that's kind of, we've kind of kept that theme throughout the book, and we thought that would be a really fun and interesting way for kids to take a look at their family background and looking at ways to do research. And so we kind of start with solving a mystery, and we go from there.
How do you talk to kids about talking to their family about this?
So we encourage kids, when they start thinking about looking into their ancestry, to start with their own family, with their parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles, as a really great foundation and a way to focus their search. And so we have some tips in here on how to interview, what we call interviewing witnesses, to keep with our detective theme. We offer them questions that they can ask, how to prepare for an interview, what to start with when you're interviewing someone, and to make sure they're asking open-ended questions so that they're getting answers that are more than just yes and no, but more details about their family background and what their parents, grandparents, and other relatives know.
It's interesting. In the introduction to the book, you go all the way back 200,000 years. I don't think they're going to go back quite that far, are they?
No, they're probably not going to go back that far. But we wanted to give them kind of a background on human migration and a little bit of information on how people kind of got around the world. But when they do their own family history, depending on where you're from and the kind of records that were kept, I think you can go pretty far back.
There's an interesting interview in the book by someone called Genealogy John. Who is he? Where'd you find him?
So he is a genealogist that's actually local to our area. We're in Washington, D.C., and he is also in Washington, D.C. And we thought it would be really fun for kids to kind of know what a real genealogist does and the kind of work that they conduct, how they got interested in it, and also offer some tips from being an expert in the field. We try to do that with a lot of our books, make sure that we kind of have an expert's perspective.
What kind of feedback have you gotten on this so far from either children or teachers?
So we've gotten some great feedback. We've been told that this book is very accessible, that it covers and kind of covers everything that kids would need to know. It also offers some great offline resources as well as online resources. And we have gotten some great star reviews from some publishing magazines that have called this book a really great resource for kids and something that can really help them figure out a lot about themselves and their families.
If a student does read this and it sparks something in them and they're really interested, they want to go a bit further, or where else can they go?
So once they've kind of started with this book, we provide resources actually in this book where kids can go dig deeper and look for more. We encourage kids to go to the Library of Congress or the National Archives or their local library or local records offices, where they can kind of dig deeper and find out more information, obviously with parents' permission, of course. And we also provide some information here on some resources in other countries, like Canada, for example. And we also offer a little bit of information for kids that may not be based in the United States, that may be elsewhere, and where they may be able to start with their research as well, and where they can dig in a little bit more. I think one of the things that makes this book really unique and really fun is that we've included some hands-on activities in here. We encourage kids to create a coat of arms for their family if their family doesn't already have one that they may have discovered. We encourage them to create a time capsule, put together a book of family recipes that they may have discovered, and also if they do find family members that they have never met before, to plan a family reunion and try to get their family together and kind of talk in person and learn more about each other.
If nothing else, looking at this book, finally explain to me what second cousin three times removed actually means.
Well, yeah, that's something that I think a lot of people find very confusing. And so we've kind of laid out in this book early on different kinds of kin. And so we talk about removals and saying that being removed doesn't mean that your cousin was plucked off your family tree, but it means that you and your cousin are from different generations and that you have a common relative or common ancestor. So we do explain different kinds of relations, which I know for me clarified a lot of things because I didn't understand what cousin once removed meant either before I read this.
Priyanka Lamachani is the senior editor at National Geographic Children's Books. The name of the new book is National Geographic Kids Guide to Genealogy. If someone asks you why you believe the facts about climate change, you can tell them a little bird told you. Well, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Climate change is having an impact on the routines of songbirds. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Michael McGran, assistant professor of environmental science at William Jessup University, looks into how an early arrival of spring in the western U.S. can throw a wrench into the songbirds' mating rituals.
Most of the birds we see and hear on a daily basis are songbirds. In the mountains of California, Oregon, and Washington, songbirds are particularly abundant and diverse. But even in these remote mountains, they are not immune to the effects of climate change. Due to climate change, warming temperatures are causing spring to arrive earlier in the year. Insects are an important food source for many songbirds and are most abundant in the spring. However, peak time for insects may be shifting to earlier dates. Many songbirds may struggle to adjust their seasonal timing of mating and raising their young to match the peak availability of their food source. Consequently, there may not be enough food to nourish their young. Song has an important role in mating behavior. Males sing to advertise their presence to females and to defend breeding territories from rival males. Patterns in singing activity are therefore a very good indicator of when these birds are actively breeding and raising their young during the spring season. In our research at thousands of sites along the Pacific Crest National Scenic Trail, which runs from Mexico to Canada, we have developed an innovative new method to track the response of singing behavior to climate change. We deploy automated bird recording devices. These recordings are later downloaded, allowing us to identify the particular species based on their song. We can now utilize our established technique in our research going forward. It will successfully enable us to track the population trends and reproductive behavior, specifically singing behavior, of songbirds to climate change. Our technique should allow our research teams to track breeding behavior over the next 10 to 20 years.
That was Michael McGran of William Jessup University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.